Hello, everyone. We are pleased to welcome Jason Brunt to the Pivot Podcast today. Jason is the president at Clayton Developments and the SVP of Shaw Real Estate and has been with the company since 2016. Shaw is one of Eastern Canada's leading community developers, residential builders, and natural resource manufacturers. He's born and raised in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and attended both St. Mary's and Mount St. Vincent Universities and played varsity basketball, a game he remains passionate about to this day. Welcome to the pod today, Jason.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
So as I mentioned in the intro, you are Halifax born and raised. You've now had quite an interesting trajectory since graduating from both of those fine universities and to get to where you are today. Could you just give us a brief background of subsequent to graduating and prior to coming back to Halifax? Give us a bit of color as to your, you know, professional kind of endeavor since that time.
Sure. After school, did a lot of smaller jobs, as you would, just to try to build some experience, marketing agencies, met life, you know, selling door to door, eat what you kill. Was picked up by Pepsi and spent a long time with them, almost 14 years, relocated five or six times. And my last role with Pepsi was in New York, managing sales and capability training for North America. And then wanted to come back home with my family, moved home, worked with Eastlink for 5 years, overseeing sales for the Eastlink business, mainly here in Atlanta, Canada, and some systems throughout the country. And then had the opportunity to join Clayton Developments as their VP of Business Development, and have been here, as you mentioned, for about 8 years, and was lucky enough to get the chair in the corner to run the place. So it's been three different industries over, you know, 15, 20 years, but learned a lot, some in consumer packaged goods, some in telco with monthly recurring revenue, and then land development. So it's been a wide learning curve, but starting to make sense of it all.
That's incredible. And I think it's one of the things you and I have in common is that we both kind of gone away and worked in big markets, but ultimately life kind of gravity pulled us back to the East Coast, and we're hearing more and more of these stories. And it was interesting, last night I was talking to a group of graduate students, and the mindset around I have to move away to really put my career on the fast path, I think, is slowly going away if you're from Halifax, because there's such an abundance of opportunity. And you know, the city is just growing leaps and bounds and really showing to young grads that, hey, we're a place that you can build a life and a career. You don't really always need to go away unless you really want to. Interesting that you mentioned that you spent some time in New York City running, a senior leadership role in Pepsi. What lessons did you learn during your time in the New York market, especially that you feel helps you be successful in this role?
Managing people is always a skill. And you know, when you get into the bigger markets and you get into the wider scopes of coverage, I think you're exposed to a lot larger, a diverse pool of backgrounds, beliefs, and, you know, work ethics. So I think, you know, throughout the course of managing branches in New Brunswick and managing regions, and then going into a role that had capacity North American based, the two big takeaways I think that have served me well, regardless of the role I've played or the hat I've worn, has been around people leadership and trying to make sure that I adjust my style accordingly. And the other one was really the analytics. I spent some time at Pepsi on the analytics floor, looking at data and trends and what those things mean. And when you look at Halifax and what it's gone through over the last 5 years, I think one of the biggest attributes I've been able to bring to this organization is really looking at data and deciphering what's to come next, a little bit of a crystal ball. When you're looking at a market that has almost 400 million in North America, and you come to back home to Nova Scotia, to Halifax, and it's growing by 30,000 and you're building 3,000-4,000 starts a year, it doesn't take huge science to uncover that you're inevitably going to hit a wall. And I think some of that pre-indicators, some of the things that we would have been communicating to market through different media streams back in 2015-16, were really a little bit ahead of what we're into today with the bottleneck or the, you know, the demand, supply and demand equation for housing in particular. So that stuff's really served me well, regardless of the industry I'm in. People are people and they have certain behavioral patterns. So if you can figure that out, you're a step ahead of the crowd. And then just looking at data and analytics and making smart strategic decisions that align with what we think is going to happen next. I think those things have proven to be very valuable in the land development business, because once you start digging holes, you can't reverse it. So that's really, really two things I think that stand out and that have made me somewhat successful in most of the roles I've played.
I think in Atlantic Canada, we like to think of ourselves as being, you know, fairly a unique group of people. We're kind of known across the country as being a friendly bunch and things like that. I'm curious if you think managing people is kind of the same regardless of where you are, or if you've noticed some huge differences between, you know, the big city in New York and moving back to Halifax.
It's a great question, and I think it's significantly different based on cultural backgrounds and upbringing. So, you know, I grew up in Sambro, which is a fishing community. So you have a lot more blue collar management, or a lot more, a bit of a different outlook on what life is supposed to be. What I've come to conclude after overseeing thousands of people in different roles is that there's three major buckets of how people respond to situations or behave. The mixes shift, but the behaviors don't. So I would say the difference with New York is you would have a lot more people on the upper echelon of making money, being successful, dressing nice, and being relevant. You come back home, that's still here. It's just 20% less of the population that put all of their, you know, self-worth into that category, yeah. Like Toronto, like the big cities, where that's really why you're probably there, or how you found yourself there if you didn't grow up there. So I'd say that the art and the skill in that is the human behavioral patterns behind balanced lifestyle with family, making money, or leaving a legacy behind. They stay consistent as key themes. The mixes shift. The more blue collar, or the more humble, or the more trustworthy a market becomes in its population, depends on, you know, how many people are in each of those buckets. People here still want to be successful and relevant, but they'd have a little bit more time and a little bit more willingness to spend time coaching or hanging out with their kids, things of that nature. In New York, it was a dog eat dog market. So if you work 16 hours, things would typically work out better for you. Here, not so much. You can work 16 hours and the boss may ask you, are you in the right job? Because it seems like you're spending too many hours to do it. I think it's just a different mindset, but the same behavioral patterns at its core.
That balanced lifestyle you mentioned, was that a big part of why you came back home?
Yeah, no, absolutely. My children have three. The youngest was starting to hit junior high level, and we had already relocated five or six times. And, you know, being from here, I think it's very important to have your roots and to know where you come from and to have a best friend. And when you move around every couple of years, I have a best friend that I've known since grade four. My kids started to talk about not having one that had the same longevity, and that bothered me. So yeah, it was time to come home, regroup, and got a bit lucky finding, you know, a unbelievable organization that's 167 years old to work for, but it also comes with that balance and that stability that you need.
I was going to ask you that, Jason. I mean, one married guy with kids to another, you know, you've got a high profile kind of professional job. You've got three kids, like you said. How do you strike that balance between home and work? What does that look like for you? So you don't feel like you're behind the eight ball in either.
It's becoming harder and harder. If you're paying attention to what's going on in the development world right now, but I would say, as a middle manager, I started to spend more time focusing on setting expectations for those around me versus setting them on myself. I've had the privilege of reinventing myself seven or eight times in different cities or with different organizations. I find what a lot of young leaders do is they set expectations that are not sustainable. And then when they come off of them to try to find balance, their senior leaders are looking at them saying, well, they're falling off. So for me, I've coached all three of my children for 20 years, some, you know, two teams at a time. I coach my daughter in high school basketball today. I've been very, very clear and continue to stay clear that that's a major priority for me, to make sure that I don't lose sight of them. And the organization either adjusts to that requirement, and it's got to be realistic. You can't be working 7 hours in a job like this, but there are times where flexing is required, and just it's so important for mid-managers or semi-senior managers to write their own playbook on what they want their lives to be and find an organization that can somewhat mold around that. And if you're very good, an organization will do that for you. Or if it's a very good organization, they'll do that for you. If you're not very good or it's not a very good organization, you'll work like a dog and you won't have balance. So I think it's a little bit on both sides. I think the big coaching I'd give to anybody who's trying to find that balance right now, which is becoming harder and harder to do, is to make sure you communicate with your leaders and your bosses around you on what you're hoping to accomplish so that it's not a surprise when you actually try to pull it off.
I want to spend some time on the nuances of development, home development, things like that. Before we start in there, can we maybe clarify, you know, so you started with the Shaw Group as, I think you said, VP of business development, and I think it was at Clayton. And then, you know, you're still with Clayton Developments, but there's also Shaw Real Estate. If you could distinguish, you know, what those roles are, and perhaps even what is Shaw Real Estate versus Clayton Developments and what the goals of those organizations are?
Yeah, sure. So I'll start at the top for 30 seconds or less. Shaw Group, 167 years old, heavy into manufacturing, heavy into land development, and those would have been the key thrust 5 years ago. As the demographic and the winds of change and COVID, you know, started to change working dynamics and people could work from anywhere, and this population thrust came in, it became quite evident that selling land solely as a commodity is not a long-term strategy for all of it anyway. So I would say right now we have five divisions in manufacturing, and we perform, you know, precast solutions, does large pipe works and bridges and culverts and piping. Resources is sand and gravel and inputs to a finished good like concrete. We would have Shaw Brick, which is heavily masonry and cladding products. We would have a pellet division that sends 180 million tons of pellets overseas to the market over there and to local distributors and resellers. On the Clayton side, it's heavily focused on land development at its core. So finding raw land, going through the very challenging process of getting it approved, which is, you know, can take up to 10 years. That's been accelerated now through government efforts, but it's a long, tedious process that takes a lot of money and a lot of patience. Then we get the approvals, build the civil infrastructure, and then take that land forward. That's really what Clayton has performed for 87 of the 167 years, was getting land ready for a developer to build upon. When I came to the organization, that model still works incredibly well, but with so much land and so much pace of play, finding an opportunity for us to be able to vertically integrate all these divisions a little bit seemed like a real good idea, because the market was hungry for growth, planning approvals started to take hold, and we spawned the Shaw Real Estate division. So Clayton would fall under Shaw Real Estate. Within Shaw Real Estate, we have four stick-build home building organizations, which build homes from scratch on top of the land. We also have a multi-division, which builds multi-res construction, and we've done several buildings and learned quite a bit, and that's from concrete, stick, panelization, to try to learn a little bit about that. That's under real estate. We have a Shaw Lifestyle division, which is really about activating our communities and our assets for retention. So kayak club, date night, wine and cheese, mix and mingle. And then within our big communities, we would have people going to different amenity spaces and different multis to meet the neighbors. And what that really does is create a sense of place. It's great for wellness, mainly with the seniors who, you know, 34% of our buildings are filled up with active aging, 55 and over. And, you know, their loneliness factor is a real thing. So it's like, how do you keep them entertained and activated in the community so that we keep them in our communities and build a brand that people trust and believe in? In addition to that, we have Prestige, which is a very large modular factory in New Brunswick. And we've started to bring those modular forms into our large A-class communities and figure out how to build modular, because labor trades can't keep up with this demand. And that's performed incredibly well. Out of the Prestige business, we would do anywhere from 12 to 15 houses from scratch a week. So it has large capacity, a large headcount, and it's 50 years old, so it knows what it's doing. So when you put all that together, it's Shaw Real Estate. And then manufacturing through association grows its business because the cladding and the bricks and the stone and the tile, et cetera, are going into some of these vertical projects. So that's really the crux of it and where we are today.
Jason, correct me if I'm wrong, but is Shaw one of, if not the largest private landowner in Atlantic Canada? Is that a factual statement?
Unless there's someone out there that we don't know that's hiding real well, yeah, that would be the case. I mean, we would right now be responsible for roughly 50% of the starts in HRM, which is a big number, obviously. And when you look at land development, we would be developing right now, currently active, about 70% of the land development through these special planning areas and other projects that pre-existed that initiative. So yeah, I would say we're likely that. I hate to say it out loud because it's not really the corporate culture here to brag about the organization, as you've learned, but it's we're definitely, if not the biggest, one of the biggest.
Did you say 167 years?
Yeah.
So older than Canada? Am I getting this right?
That's correct. Yeah. So okay. Canada would be 155 or something now. We had our 150 there a handful of years ago, and that was kind of the internal joke was we're older than Confederation. And it started really with Shaw Brick, which was, you know, where it all started. And we had clay reserves, built some kilns, built some brick. And then after the Halifax explosion, if you go downtown, you'll see a whole lot of red brick. So we rebuilt a lot of the city. But after that rebuild was done, what did we do with the brick? So we started a land division with the primary intent of really finding a place to clad. And to this day, we have covenants where if you build in our communities, you need a minimum of 30% cladding from Shaw Brick to make sure that business can self-sustain and can grow with us. So that's kind of the path. Clayton Park would have been one of our early developments that is quite robust now around Lacewood and Dumbrac. And very easy to see who they're tied to when you drive through there because of the amount of brick and cladding that would come from manufacturing. So it's, very true, very old. Which also allowed, you know, land purchases. When you're buying land 100 years ago and you wait, it's a good asset to hold for a long time. And if you're lucky enough to have it, when the demographic and the analytics look like they do today, you know, you should have a decent business if you know what you're doing.
Just honestly, just record keeping alone sounds like a nightmare from buying something 100 years ago. You know what I mean? I think like when did the now migrated system came in, like what, 2003 or something, like that we actually know who owns what to some degree, right? I just find that's all amazing, and the idea of Clayton Park being not there is kind of odd to me too, you know.
We have Colby South and Summer Fairview and Clayton Park and the West Bedfords and the Ravines and the Cotton Mill Creek and the Solomon. So we've branded away from Shaw so that it, you know, they were all independent organizations or independent communities. But right now the math would say about one in every six residents live in a Clayton community in HRM.
And so you must have people in as you've risen through the ranks at Shaw and you're doing some tremendous work. I mean, you must have so many people acting like your best friend to want to get these developing rights and just make progress happen in the city. How do you manage all of these competing agendas, competing interests, and trying to achieve the organization's objectives while also building Halifax? It must get tricky.
It's tricky because you don't want to take on roles and responsibilities you shouldn't as a private sector developer. And what I mean by that is government populace will drive the need. And what we've tried to stay grounded in is serving the need and just staying focused on what the deliverable is. So right now, as an example, with our tiny homes project in Cobequid, there's a need for homelessness. We have a modular factory and we can use that for good because it can be built through the winter and then placed all in a real quick. So it is tricky, but I would say a lot of it's somewhat common sense. What can people afford to pay? What's the end objective? Create more housing. What and how do we impact that? And I'd say the more tricky part of it is trying to make sure that we share that growth with the other developers and other builders in the city so that it doesn't become one for all, right? So it's the home builders have to find their way. More home builders have to find their way back into communities. There's a lot of liquidity in the market now, and especially as HST and these things start to be adjusted or removed, the demand for multi, that segment has risen grossly in the last month because of that news. And just trying to make sure that you're carving enough up for everyone to be able to participate, knowing in the back of our minds, everyone's minds here, that labor trade can only carry you so far, that it's only capable of building so many units in Annam unless innovative ways like modular and other come to market. So it's a lot to think about. It's big business and it's big money. The hardest thing to navigate right now, if I'm being honest, is when you build a community, an 800-acre community, and you invest millions of dollars into infrastructure, you don't see a return on that for 5 years. So and as interest rates have gone up 8 times in the last 2 years, what used to cost us X now costs us Y. And how do you make sure you're not pushing so much money to the end consumer because it takes so long to civil develop that you're actually pricing yourself out of the market by mistake? So
yeah,
that's the trickiest part right now is after development approvals are given and you get a stamp of paper that says you're allowed to build this community, it takes 4 years to get keys in someone's hands for a residence. That's the hard part. Is it's not a, oh, you got your paper, when can you start building? The pipe's got to go under the ground, the blasting has to happen, the environmental expectation, all of that takes years, and then you got to build a house or an apartment building on it.
You mentioned affordability earlier, and let's touch on that briefly because your group is doing some tremendous work, especially in the area of prefab homes, and you briefly touched on it earlier. But to what extent do you see your role and maybe Shaw more broadly as addressing the need for affordable housing in the province?
We have an obligation to serve it as much as we can. And that's from two threads. One of them, the corporate culture of the Shaw Group is, you know, Shaw Wilderness Park, one of the nicest pieces of land we've owned in Halifax off of Purcell's Cove Road that was given back to keep as a park. As a land development company, as the president of Clayton, it's a tough thing to, you know, I'm torn. It's the right thing to do, but look where it sits. You're right in the heart of the universe. And that was a 400-acre land mass given for a park. So I'd say we're obligated through the corporate culture to make sure that we serve that need because we're 167 years old and our life depends on making sure we're keeping this a vibrant and growing region. The second part of that, which is more financial than just business practice, is the housing continuum doesn't move until that sector is served properly, which means if we don't help solve a large percentage of the median income and below requirement, then the whole wheel starts to look weird because you have people, more affluent people with bigger wallets, destroying C-class inventory and building a $1 million house. So you actually further exacerbate, if you don't get the whole thing working right, the crippling or demolishing or redeveloping of the lowest priced housing to build what they want. And then it becomes a pig in a python. You can't figure out how to clear it. So the modular world that we perform in and that we can do some real big damage in because we can produce 1,000 units a year. If we get that right in the Mount Hopes, in the Penhorns, in the tiny villages and rural pocket communities, we can't really grow the top end of our portfolio at the pace we want either. So you got to get everyone, you got to get all the dynamics and all the analytics correct so the wheel will spin as fast as possible. But governments, banks, a lot of other organizations that look at more of a global, larger scale strategy than just little old Halifax will want to see an organization like ours participating in as many segments as possible so that you're not a one-hit wonder. You're not, you know, you're diversified across the economic landscape, if you will. So I would hope that we would represent in all tiers of pricing our fair share. If we represent X percent for the development world as Clayton, we should represent that similar outlook for every pricing tier. And then the one we were missing, so we, like Mount Hope, the homes over there, townhouses, will come with a three on them. We haven't seen a three here on a townhouse in a long time, but that's the power of modular. And that's the power of having the land development underneath the module you're bringing, because the timing, there's no white space between land getting completed and a house getting completed. I already know what the plan is, right from trees to keys. So you can remove a year, which costs money, and you can build it in a factory with cheaper labor per hour and send it down the road in the back of a truck. And as long as we demonstrate that that lends itself to $200,000 discount versus the norm, everyone's winning. So I think it's really just a fair share comment. If you represent 20% of something, within that 20% are all people represented. The big gap we had in our strategy was around homeless, the real, real bottom. You know, Mount Hope is for attainable. That's median income. That's regular people making regular money that can't find a home. That's what it's tailored towards, and a little bit below. But then there's this big gap at the bottom of people who are really, really, really in a bad space. And we're going to be able to now do this pilot out there and see if it works. And if we're onto something there, I'm sure a lot of the module companies will come on board and think about that, because it's an opportunity. And then we should be able to really multiply the impact. That's the hope for.
Along with the same vein as it relates to affordability, you mentioned earlier that 34% of the 34% of the people are, I think you called it active aging, or maybe it's over 55. I don't know exactly what you said, but is that on purpose? Like, are you guys building any retirement community, or is it just a reflection of the population in Nova Scotia?
It's a reflection of the typical demo. So that what I referenced there was, in a 100-unit multi-site, we'll have 35 units rented to people over 55, a big midsection, 40-something percent that are everyone else, and then you'll get some students that, or singles that fall in, that are all over the place, right? So that's the mix. Anything above that active aging, you start to get to 65, 75, that's when the other organizations that do healthcare kind of step in, and they're in a big push right now too, to try to serve that need, so we don't end up putting people that need help into regular assets, regular multi-assets, without the support they need. So those numbers are really driven directly off of the current demo in the market. What's happening as of late, you know, with 32% East Indian population growth and 20% Asian and the rest of it interprovincial, intra-provincial, you have to kind of design your communities a little different, because 32% is a big percentage. And, you know, they have their own needs and lifestyles that we're trying to catch up to, quite frankly. And all of that's coming into play right now as we model out these communities. But it's tough. It's tough to manage, because it's easy to build the same thing over and over again, but it's not necessarily what the market wants, because there's a lot of new faces in town.
What are your thoughts on rental versus condos, given the price to build at the moment?
I think Toronto has a large condo universe, because they ran into the exact same thing we're running into now, which is a stick-built home is out of reach, a new one for a lot of people, and you need, you know, an income of over 100,000 to make that a reality, well over 100,000 in a lot of cases. So the next best option, we only have 7 or 8% condo in this market, as you know, which is the lowest in the country for major cities. I think it's a natural next step, and we have some in the pipeline, and that's because the delta between regular standalone housing in a condo is about 25%. So it opens up another tier of buying opportunity that allows for equity growth. Again, another responsibility of big development is to make sure people can build equity, or they can never move into my West Bedfords. You got, like, it's all a continuum, right? So if you never build equity, you're stuck in a rental forever. And my 800 acre communities that have a whole bunch of ground based, 50%, as standalone housing for people's families, starts to fall off. And you can't just build concrete jungles all the time, because it becomes problematic from a socioeconomic perspective, you end up with a lot more bad news if you just jam too many people into the same small acreage. So condo will grow. It's a fact. It's already underway. And the hope for is, you know, there's $100,000 to $150,000 differential between that option and a house that will allow people to find their way into building some equity to hopefully get out of that and take a nickel and go to the next stage in their life. So it's going to happen. It's where, how fast, and so what happened in the last 2 years is that the difference between multi-rental and housing mortgages existed. The rental market now is at par with mortgages because the housing demand and the supply is so out of whack that, and because of caps, rental caps, if you're building a new asset, you're putting the highest sticker price on it you possibly can in case you can't tomorrow for sustainability and to make sure you're safe. So you, through default, the starting rents of new assets are higher than they should be because no one investing that type of money knows what they can take over the next 5 years for increases to combat power, insurance, and all the other bills in your operating expense lines that are going up quickly, and interest at the end of the day. So a condo will come in a big way. You'll see half buildings, you know, twin towers with one side condo, one side not, but it will target a new buying group that starts likely with a four. And that's kind of the missing tier in the market, is that $400,000 to $550,000 price band right now is very hard to find unless a home is 25 to 35 years old.
I think when it comes to, you know, we're mentioning condo developments and affordable housing, and you referenced that the analytics were in your favor right now as it relates to, you know, building homes and, you know, people needing homes. The provincial government just came out and commented on this quite specifically this week, in fact. I think it seems to me that us and everybody we're speaking with, unless I'm way out to lunch, is an agreement that we need more homes, right? I guess the question is, you guys seem to be doing a whole bunch of very specific things. If we can look outside of, you know, Clayton and the Shaw Group for a moment, what will it actually take for us to meet these, in my opinion, very aggressive goals of building homes in the coming years?
It's not going to be easy, and the targets you're reading about right now are unprecedented for the market here. As you know, the numbers and our current trend lines don't meet. If we do everything right, I think in 6 years, we could see ourselves starting to come out the other side, but it would take a lot of things to go right. The two areas that bring me optimism that we can figure this out is that we're a region where there's a lot. I'll rephrase. This region does not have 1,000 developers. There's about 12 or 13 people that do about 80% of the big work in development. And as long as we are working with one another and communicating so I would talk to all developers in the city, and I know what some of them are doing in a big way. So I'm probably not going to go and do the exact same thing. And that's really the difference with this market versus big markets that don't have that nimbleness still, is that you may end up with all three of us building the exact same asset to the exact same target market. And that really causes problems. So what we're trying to do is a bit of divide and conquer, where you have $3,000 rents downtown. So I should stay in a lane and maybe build the next tier down of multi-res. For B class, I'd call it, or not, you know, all glass and really high price per square foot. So if everyone stays in their lane, if we do that segmenting, we'll just through catering to a lot of tiers, help ourselves get ahead of the trend a little bit. Governments, all levels of government in this province, are, as much as they're working on how to maneuver this universe, they're all recognizing and understanding that the need is there. So no one's debating we need way more houses and we need it now. That's great. How they get there and the way they move through legislation is something I watch, but don't try to interfere too much in, as long as they're all heading to a common goal, which it seems like they are. And then the last one I would speak to is really innovation and new ways of building. Modular being one that's an old idea, And there's a taboo on trailer parks in some cases, but modular can build a whole lot of things. And it's not just trailer parks. We can stack townhouses. We can build one level living. We can do anything you pretty much need now because the sophistication and the technology has improved with the times. So if those three things, if government stays focused on understanding the problems and works with developers to come to a common ground that works for all, great. If new forms and new innovation are allowed into communities, meaning the bylaws will allow them, great, that further accelerates. If you get modular, you can double your performance versus our stick build performance with trade labor today. And then lastly, and the big one that no one has a crystal ball on yet, is how long will interest and, you know, inflation continue to put some headwind against pace? So that's really the key thrust. And I think we're doing all of the above. I think right now, if I look at this particular organization and all the other majors that I would hang out with, everyone's doing more. And the big challenge was taxation and interest hitting at the exact same time. HST and interest both without getting to rents that are not sustainable. If you get past $3,000 rent in this market in too many places, it's tough to see that lasting for a long, long time with median incomes. So that's really it.
Yeah. Wow. Well, great answer. And Jason, we're coming to a close on this great chat, and I'll ask my last question before Jeff brings us home here. But, you know, you've obviously in your professional career, I mean, you've had a tremendous amount of experiences and no doubt have learned a lot. And just listening to you speak today has been quite eye opening. What is one thing that Jason today wishes that Jason 20 years ago knew that you would tell him?
I think the biggest one, if I'm being honest with myself, it's a good question, and it's always hard to self-reflect too deep because I feel like crying on the podcast, but I'll say the biggest advice I'd give myself would be to not have been so tough on myself when I failed. And I know that seems cliche, but I failed a lot. I broke a lot of things, and in a lot of cases, it would have been the difference on, you know, being fired or getting promoted. You know, that's how material some of the decisions, but I was incredibly hard on myself when things didn't work out the way my mind thought they would. In retrospect, looking back, the only reason I can stick handle the agenda I have right now, which is, you know, Clayton's big, multi-business is big, home building is a lot of money and a lot of risk. And Prestige has over 200 people at it. So it's a big operation. The failure parts of my past, I would have swallowed hard, made a note, and moved on instead of sitting for a month and being second guessing my next move. I think that's really the one that I tell my kids every day, like, without failure comes no growth. And again, every TED Talks will say the same type of thing, but it's very legit. There's a reason you hear it a lot. It's because everyone that gets to 50 starts going, man, I probably lost 3 years of growth and success looking over my shoulder because one thing didn't go exactly the way I put it on a piece of paper. That's exactly what I would tell myself, and I try to live by that today. Still messing up a ton of stuff. Still break. You can't come in from Pepsi and run this company and not break some things. It's about how do you respond once you break them. What do you do tomorrow? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people start to shy away from it. And what I'm noticing now in the new millennial group coming through leadership, they haven't had to deal with failure as much as people that came from my era. Therefore, when they do fail, like if I postponed my next move 2 weeks, if I came up a little rougher around the edges, for people who have never failed, will it take them 6 months to recover? And then leadership, you know, we need new leaders to replace me. Are they going to have enough life experience and enough failure to be capable of taking on a role that matters? That's the advice. That's the advice I give to my whole organization. I expect you to make mistakes. And if you're not making any mistakes, I don't want you, because it means you're vanilla and it means it's going to be the same thing till you're dead. So I foster and promote slight misses, large ones, maybe not so much, but, you know, sucking over it or crying over it lends itself to weakness. And I don't think this market this region. I think we can be the fastest growing region in Canada that offers the balance between lifestyle, social, and raising a family and being able to go to the beach and being able to go skiing. I think it offers a lot. It's a mini Vancouver. We should be learning our lessons from the Calgarys, the Torontos, the Montreals, and the Vancouvers, and we are. We're starting to bring it here. Let's just make sure that we're building infrastructure and planning for the future. And if we do that and we're not scared to fail at a few things, we'll be good to go.
Yeah, and a lot of the time I'll end these things asking about, you know, optimism. And it's kind of one of those, sometimes I feel it's silly even asking you, are you optimistic? Because, you know, we've heard so many things that you've said that I know you're going to answer that you are. But also, people that do what we do, Marcel and I, or what you do, there's no such thing as pessimistic people. We just wouldn't do these things. If we didn't think things would work out and be fine, we wouldn't be in the positions we are today, right? And we can come up, we touched on a few of them, right? Real concerns, right? You know, homelessness, inflation, interest rates sky high, two major wars in the world right now, a political environment where it seems like nobody can get along. And I don't mean locally, I just mean generally, right? Why are you optimistic more specifically?
Yeah, I think humanitarians are optimistic because they fundamentally believe in keeping the peace and living a good life while you're here. I'm a blind optimist by nature, which means I always believe if there's a will, there's a way. I think most people that grew up in this market believe that because it doesn't take too many chapters behind us to see one of our groups struggling. Like for me, it's the crew right behind me. For some, it might be two crews behind, but there's a disproportionate amount of this market that has worked to get here. It didn't come through association or through you woke up in the morning and things worked out well. My optimism is really driven by two things. I have faith in people, and I think most people want to do the best they can, and science, analytics, data. I'm optimistic because if the people who make the rules above us want to solve the problem, and the people who in private sector can build to solve the problem, those are two very, very good things as a starting block. If you layer on top of that the data that's on paper and how many people want to come and are coming here, that's the missing link. If you build it, they will come. That's a fact. And right now, when people are Googling all over the world where to go, it's turning into less about the destination and more about availability. There are global conflicts that are probably at the worst I may see in my life evolving around us. Not just economically, but when you look overseas, it's not hard to see this thing can turn very challenging. And a mass exodus usually occurs immediately following that, which we've seen a bit of in COVID, and we've seen a bit of it through Russia, Ukraine, and it continues to happen. This latest turmoil will further exacerbate that same problem, where if you're not grossly religious and you're not grossly tied to your where you live, where do I go? And right now, I think it's a race on whoever can build out access for housing and safety wins. And we have to be very careful that we don't start getting to a point where we're so slow to respond that living here costs the same as Montreal, because we don't have as much to offer as those places with NHL teams, right? So we're right at that very, very, very critical spot where if we do what we say we're going to do from the top down, we will have housing for people looking. And I believe affordable housing and access to housing will supersede where. If it's safe and it exists, I'll consider it. And that's through necessity more than it is anything else because of the global situation we're in. So I'm optimistic because I think we can do all of the above. I'm optimistic because I oversee an organization that represents a large chunk of the capability and the access if we do it right, and we want to do that. And now you made a comment earlier about, you know, disruption and conflict. The fights we're having across the land will norm and storm their way out to direction and to approvals and to, you know, no HST. And those are very, very good signs that as much as there's people debating over who owns the mic, in the background of all that concurrently, we're still seeing these things happen. So, you know, if the fight was so large that HST didn't happen, or, you know, land wasn't getting approved through HRM, then I wouldn't be as optimistic. But that stuff's happening real time. And then there's separate debates and that happen normally. But I think we all need to stay optimistic, or we're going to fall behind other cities who are.
Well said. Now, we might not get an NHL team, but we had the mayor on. He guaranteed us a CFL team, didn't he? I heard 100% guarantee, if I remember, on record.
Well, I'm glad you put it into this podcast as a subtle reminder to Mr. Savage that he said that.
Mayor Mike,
because I think that would be welcomed as well from this side.
Well, build it and they will come. I don't know about you, Jeff, but I always love to end these things with a good Field of Dreams reference. Absolutely. So, Jason, thank you for doing this. It's been an absolute pleasure, and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.